Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In the news this week, an historic first. The leaders of North and South Korea meet face-to-face and pledge to work towards a new era of peace. International news made headlines closer to home as well. President Emmanuel Macron of France came to Washington. Wednesday, he addressed Congress.
Both in the United States and in Europe, we are living in a time of anger and fear because of this current global threats. But these feelings do not build anything.
More tumult in President Trump's cabinet. Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson won't be the next head of the Veterans Administration. And embattled EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt grilled again by lawmakers.
Facts are facts and fiction is fiction. And a lie doesn't become truth just because it appears on the front page of the newspaper. Much of what has been targeted towards me and my team has been half-truths or, at best, stories that have been so twisted they do not resemble reality.
And Bill Cosby is now a convicted man. Yesterday, he was found guilty of 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault. Here's Gloria Allred, who represented some of his accusers after the verdict.
Bill Cosby, 3 words for you. Guilty, guilty, guilty!
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley, Shauna Thomas, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. And you can join us on air or online. Are you hopeful for a possible peace now on the Korean Peninsula? Or are you still weary? And beyond the friendship between Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump, what did you see in this first ever state visit hosted by the Trump administration? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Michael Crowley, national security editor and senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Also with us from Washington is Shauna Thomas, Washington bureau chief for Vice News. Shauna, it's good to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, join us. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna, Michael, and Sean.
Well, Michael, I wanted to start with you, and I actually wanted to provide a bit of clarification. I said a historic first about this North and South Korean summit. It's the first time a North Korean leader has set foot in the South.
Right.
So tell us, how meaningful was what happened on the peninsula?
So I think that what we saw was breathtaking in its symbolism and really an unforgettable photo op. Substantively, and that is what all of this will turn on in the coming months, we did not see a fundamental change in the dynamics that make reaching an agreement with North Korea extremely difficult to try to see the dismantlement of its nuclear program. But you know, the psychology of negotiations like this are very important. The symbolism is very important. So there are two ways you can look at this. You know, optimistically, you can say, wow, Kim Jong-un, who I think rightly has a reputation as a strange, homicidal dictator, seems to be stepping out of his shell a little bit. He actually, I think one of the most striking things about this was showed sort of flashes of self-deprecating humor, made a joke about how the roads in North Korea were a little bit embarrassing. Is this a guy who actually wants to engage with the world, who doesn't want to be a hermit, who maybe has a personality that we might even be able to relate to on some level? And does that mean he's willing to make major concessions regarding his nuclear program in exchange for normalized relations with the outside world and the lifting of economic sanctions? That's the positive. The negative is this more of North Korea? Is this an even savvier version of the kind of game that North Korea has been playing now for 20 years, where it says it wants to make concessions, it says it wants to do deals, it buys time, and then it lies and cheats and carries on intimidating and threatening? And it all falls apart again. We've seen this happen before. And so a lot of people are very skeptical. But I will say this is historic. This is dramatic. And I think there is reason to think it could be different this time.
Okay. So to the point of we've seen this happen before, right? June 2000, October 2007, two other previous summits between the leaders of North and South Korea where there was talk of achieving greater security and possibly even ending ongoing hostilities between the two nations. And nevertheless, here we find ourselves with a highly nuclearized North Korea. Jack Beatty, to Michael Crowley's point about this being a spectacular photo op, but still thin on the details. The headlines, though, are that the leaders agreed to try to work towards ridding the peninsula of nuclear weapons and then also possibly even achieving a real peace treaty rather than armistice.
Well, yeah, that's substance in the wind. There's no question about that. But, you know, the symbolism, we have a president who deals in symbolism. And if Mr. Kim is smart, and he appears to, Michael instances his humor, he appears to be smart, he will praise Mr. Trump. He will flatter Trump. He will go on about the great opening that Trump has created for peace in Korea. And I think that kind of symbolism, the headline making and so on, I think that will generate its own psychological momentum for some kind of deal. Obviously, it's going to be short of what either side wants maximally. But I don't for a minute underrate Mr. Trump's ability to label anything that comes out of this a success and to sell it in that way.
Well, to Jack's point, Shauna, I mean, the president today tweeted, Korean War to end. The United States and all of its great people should be very proud of what is now taking place in Korea. We are not there yet by any stretch of the imagination.
No, we are far away from that. But I do think there is one thing to be said for, we talked about President Trump's unpredictability. It's hard to know what he's going to do or say from time to time. Maybe that had some effect on the situation. I also think, you know, to the other point about flattering the president, to relate that to something else that we saw this week with President Macron from France being here, you know, Macron did sort of an amazing job in the lead up to this of flattering President Trump. And what he got was a small military review at the White House. He spoke in front of Congress. He got the actual state dinner trappings. He was the first president to get it. He got that kind of media attention that all presidents and leaders want. Kim Jong-un wants that as well. Mm. And while media is tightly controlled in North Korea, he will be able to make sure that those pictures of him shaking hands with the South Korean president get there. And he is, I suspect, is going to like the effect that has on the world and the effect that has on his own people. And he's going to want that meeting with President Trump, and he's going to want that photo op. And while we don't know if this is going to lead to actually denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, we do know that through flattery, at least the conversation might actually continue.
Yeah. So, Michael, before we leave this news about Korea and turn to Macron, as Shauna rightly mentioned, I'm still thinking about, you know, 2000 and 2007, and now we have 2018. Given everything that we've discussed here, what, you know, should be the steps that North and South Korea, China, the United States ought to take so that perhaps we do actually get closer to a genuine lasting peace rather than sort of the starts and stops from the previous summits?
Right. So, you know, I think what you have to do is incremental trust building. You would negotiate an agreement that works in stages where North Korea takes verifiable steps in exchange for you know, gradual lifting of sanctions and normalization. You link progress on the one to the other, and people can look at the Iran nuclear deal as a model. You know, for instance, the Iran nuclear deal actually had an interim component before the final version was sealed in July of 2014. I think about a year earlier, several months earlier, there was an interim agreement that did just that. You start the process of denuclearization with the process of lifting sanctions and normalizing relations somewhat, and you just kind of hold hands and take one baby step at a time, get your balance, and figure out whether you can trust each other, whether it seems to be working, and you can take bigger and bigger steps as you get that comfort level. But it's going to be really hard, and at the end of the day, possibly the hardest thing about this is how are you going to verify that the North Koreans are really doing what they're saying and they're not secretly starting other programs out of sight. They've done that sort of thing before. In a country as closed and paranoid as North Korea, to expect that international inspectors are going to be able to come in and snoop around these sensitive sites is a really hard thing to imagine. And that's possibly going to be the toughest part of all of this. So again, we are very far away from a deal that really works in the real world in practical terms. There are a lot of hopeful signs. I still think there's a lot of reason for skepticism.
Right. You know, and to the diplomatic apparatus that would be required to achieve all that you talked about, at least we have a Secretary of State now. But in terms of the State Department itself, not quite sure we have the person power there to achieve all this. But since you mentioned the Iran nuclear deal, it's the perfect way to transition to the fact that Emmanuel Macron did indeed visit Washington this week in the first ever state visit hosted by President Donald Trump. And when Macron addressed a joint meeting of Congress on Wednesday, he urged the president not to abandon the Iran nuclear deal that's working to limit Iran's nuclear program.
This agreement may not address all concerns, and very important concerns. This is true. But we should not abandon it without having something substantial and more substantial instead.
A day before that, though, the president himself said no one knows if he's going to want to stay in the or if he's going to stay in the Iran nuclear deal. This is at a press conference with Macron on Tuesday.
If I do what some people expect, whether or not it will be possible to do a new deal with solid foundations, because this is a deal with decayed foundations. It's a bad deal. It's a bad structure. It's falling down. Should have never, ever been made.
Shauna Thomas, we just got a minute here before the break, but what was the impact of or the significance of Macron's visit here?
I mean, I think the significance was he was sort of propelled on the world stage in a way that that every world leader wants. So that's number one. But his speech in front of Congress, which was very interesting, had a list of things that seem kind of opposed to President Trump's worldview. He tiptoed around a couple of things. He knows the role that he is playing. But, you know, in terms of the Iran deal, he said he wanted to stay in. In terms of the Paris deal, he said he thinks the United States will come back into it. It was a message that he was sending to Congress to work with him. It was a message he was sending to President Trump that he's not letting go of all of the things he thinks is important.
Well, we are talking about the week in the news and what a week it has been. You can join the conversation. What's your take on this historic summit between North and South Korea? And when we come back, we'll talk about other stuff, including Michael Cohen and his plan to take the fifth regarding his business with President Donald Trump. We're joined today by Michael Crowley, Shauna Thomas, and Jack Beatty. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Ever listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the week in the news. What do you make of the fact that Ronny Jackson has withdrawn his name for nominee to be the next head of the VA? Also, the EPA's Scott Pruitt defended his ethics and spending again before Congress. I'm speaking with Shauna Thomas. She's Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. With Jack Beatty, he's On Point news analyst, and Michael Crowley, National Security Editor and Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Jack, before the break, we were talking about Emmanuel Macron's state visit here to Washington, and I just wanted to get your take on it, because it was the first time that President Trump hosted a world leader here, and he chose Macron.
Yes, and from all reports, it went well. There were cringeworthy moments, the president pulling a fleck of dandruff off Mr. Macron's lapel, but apparently the state dinner went very well. People are giving Mrs. Trump very high marks. It was notable that Mr. Trump seemed to exchange more kisses with Mr. Macron than with his own wife, but let's let that pass. I was struck, just to go back to that speech that Shauna referenced, that was really something, that speech before before Congress. I mean, E.J. Dionne calls it a full-scale takedown of Trumpism. Hmm. President Macron inveighed against extreme nationalism, protectionism. He championed climate change. He said there is no planet B. And he defended the international liberal order, all of which, in one way or another, is the opposite of President Trump. And in a good and in a really gifted phrase, he said, let's make our planet great again.
Right. You know, but Michael Crowley, he started the week speaking to Chris Wallace on Fox News, right? Speaking to the president's most ardent supporters through that venue.
Well, he's a savvy guy, absolutely. And just to add one note to what Jack just said, you know, I think for all the world, it could have been a Barack Obama State of the Union speech or even a Hillary Clinton campaign speech. It really lined up with that kind of center-left, U.S. Democratic philosophy. But Macron, at 40 years old, a guy nobody thought was going to be the president of France a couple of years ago, has demonstrated that he is a very intelligent and sophisticated politician, played Washington and played Donald Trump extremely well, understood that when you're in Trump's presence, when he is focused on you, the way to work with him is to flatter him, to get along, to tell him variations of what he wants to hear. But I'm sure back in Paris, people were kind of freaking out. Trump's approval ratings are at about 10%. Macron goes to the Congress and in a message, I think, to the non-Trump part of America and also to his domestic audience makes clear that their sort of touchy-feely relationship is only skin deep and that I see the world fundamentally differently from this guy. But I think the implicit message, which he sort of teased at but never quite said explicitly, was, look, I disagree with this guy on 30 different fundamental values, but we've got to work with him. And, you know, it may be a bit of an exaggeration, but it's like the old saying, you know, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. I don't know if he would call Trump an enemy, but I think philosophically they are very opposed. But his view is, I got to keep this guy close because we have to work with the United States. And bad as I think Trump may be, he's worse if he's off on his own and we're not talking to him and we're not at least making some kind of finding some partial common ground together.
Well, there's a lot of news that's happened on the domestic front here, so I want to get to some of that at least. In his call yesterday to Fox and Friends, President Trump did acknowledge that his longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, had represented him in the Stormy Daniels situation. It was the first time the president has conceded his connection to Cohen's deal in which Cohen paid $130,000 to Stormy Daniels.
Michael would represent me and represent me on some things. He represents me, like with this crazy Stormy Daniels deal, he represented me and from what I see, he did absolutely nothing wrong.
Shauna Thomas, Stormy Daniels lawyer Michael Avenatti tweeted very soon after that, very interesting, interview, Mr. President. Thanks for sharing the information. How significant was it that the president conceded this?
I mean, it's pretty significant in terms of at least that particular case. There was some hair of difference that maybe Michael Cohen had gone off on his own to give this money to Stormy Daniels. Maybe he was trying to protect the president without the president knowing. There was at least you could come up with reasons why President Trump wouldn't have been directly involved in this. Once President Trump sort of puts himself in the room to a certain extent, then you have the problem of it makes the case about whether this was an FEC violation, whether this was related to the election, a donation, if you will, even stronger, and it's hard to keep President Trump out of it. I think the other thing it does is it shows how badly President Trump needs a good personal lawyer. And I don't know if Rudy Giuliani is that person.
I was going to ask.
He has Rudy Giuliani now, who is, you know, a former U.S. attorney from New York. So he has a grasp of the law, clearly. But all of the people who you would normally think a president would go to and who would jump at representing the president, whether it be because of Mueller or because of anything else, aren't really coming to President Trump. And if he had someone who he trusted, and maybe Rudy Giuliani is this person since they do have a personal relationship to a certain extent, he needs someone who can tell him to stop talking.
Well, let's take a call here. Craig is calling from New Orleans. You're on the air, Craig.
Hi, Magna. Yes, it's Greg. I want to thank you for taking my call, first-time caller here. So I wanted to touch on the Michael Cohen situation with him pleading the fifth. It seems that the media, specifically, I guess the left media, is going nuts about it. I guess they have selective memory. There was nine officials linked to Obama that pled the fifth, including one of the most one of the most notorious and the most popular would be Lois Lerner. You had Clinton's official who pled the fifth, Imran Awad, and a major.
Craig, I'm really sorry to gotta jump in on you here, but your cell phone connection is not your fault. But it sounds like you're talking from inside a tin can. But I think what Craig was trying to say, Jack, let me just turn to you with this, is that perhaps people shouldn't be so up in arms that Michael Cohen says he would take the fifth in this investigation, because that has happened before with people who that were asked to testify during the Hillary Clinton email investigations, for example. So what's the big deal, Jack?
Sure. And the lawyers on television say that's the right thing to do because this is a civil case with Stormy Daniels. At the same time, Mr. Cohen is under criminal investigation, and they say it's really bad practice to be in a civil case talking when you're facing criminal exposure. So I think probably any lawyer would give him that advice. But, you know, there was a second significant thing about Mr. Trump's effusion on Fox and Friends yesterday, and that is that he essentially destroyed his own case with Mr. Cohen. He had, for a week now, he's been talking about attorney-client privilege. You can't look at those documents because they, you know, the FBI took in New York because it's all privileged. And then he says in the interview, Cohen only handled a tiny, tiny part of my vast business. I you know, just a little bit of my lawyering. About an hour later, or several hours later, the government, that is to say, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, which is against Cohen in this case, cited what Mr. Trump said by way of saying to the judge, look, the president says it's only a tiny part of the business that he gave to Mr. Cohen. So what's all this talk about attorney-client privilege? It can only affect a small amount of what we've got. Oh, that was a disaster for the president.
Yeah. You know, sorry, was that you, Michael?
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in one point to the caller talking about, you know, Democrats who have taken the Fifth Amendment. Yes, I mean, people should be able to take the Fifth Amendment in this country. It's your constitutional right. It doesn't necessarily mean you're guilty. I think one thing to point out here, though, is Donald Trump has ridiculed associates of Hillary Clinton and I think also President Obama for having taken the Fifth and quite memorably said at a campaign rally, the mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment? And it is one of so many cases where Trump has set the standard for himself. So if Donald Trump is going to go out and talk that way, it is only fair for him to expect people to hold him to that standard. And if he wants to say if you take the fifth, that's really suspicious, and then his personal lawyer takes the fifth, I just don't think that either he or his supporters can be very upset when people say, boy, that's pretty weird, and that deserves a lot of scrutiny. I mean, I think they've really given up a lot of the doubt.
You know, Sean, I'm wondering what you think about that, because on the other hand, the president being inconsistent in his statements versus his actions is I think that obviously we're at the stage where that's not entirely unusual, and it doesn't seem to have had any ramifications on him whatsoever.
No, it really hasn't. And I mean, I think we live in this weird political world right now where the world that President Trump lives in isn't the politics that we are used to, right? So he can say diametrically opposed things, or he can refuse to acknowledge that he said something before. And politically, he has some type of magic fairy dust that allows that to be okay. But from a legal standpoint, the fact that he says inconsistent things in the public record is something that will come back sooner or later to haunt him when it comes back up in court, when it comes back up in depositions, if he were to actually take one. And it makes him less credible. It makes him not a great witness. And that's something that maybe we won't see play out while he is still president, but it is something that is problematic for him with all of these legal issues going on that he is somewhat related to.
So I want to just take a moment here to take a little journey journey through the cabinet of President Donald Trump, because there's been a lot of tumult there this week. First of all, as we recall, Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson had withdrawn his name for consideration to be the next head of the VA. And during the president's call with Fox and Friends yesterday, Trump praised Jackson, even as we know that Jackson had been accused of mishandling prescription drugs and for even being drunk while traveling with the president. Nevertheless, President Trump said he was a good man.
He would have done a great job. He's got a tremendous heart.
Any idea who you might...
know, these are all false accusations that were made. These are false. They're trying to destroy a man. By the way, I did say welcome to Washington. Welcome to the swamp.
So that's what's going on with the VA at the moment. On the other hand, Mike Pompeo was sworn in yesterday as Secretary of State, and he came to Brussels as quickly as he could because he believes that NATO's mission is important.
I did come straight away. I was sworn in yesterday afternoon, hopped on a plane, and came straight here. There's good reason for that. The work that's being done here today is invaluable.
And over at EPA, Scott Pruitt defended himself on Capitol Hill yesterday against what he calls very troubling media reports on his performance as EPA administrator.
I promise you that I, more than anyone, want to establish the hard facts and provide answers to questions surrounding these reports. Let me be very clear. I have nothing to hide as it relates to how I've run the agency for the past 16 months.
Shauna Thomas, I mean, you were saying a little earlier that there's this sort of strange new political reality that so much tumult doesn't really have that much of an effect. But here we have one week in which, you know, the president gets a win with a confirmation with Mike Pompeo, but there's still so much upheaval in his cabinet.
There is. And the magic fairy dust that I referred to is really like a President Trump thing. It doesn't necessarily trickle down to the whole cabinet. I think the interesting thing you said, that Scott Pruitt wanted to talk about how some of what is happening right now to him is the media's fault, and that's fine. But I do think it's worth acknowledging that there are five different government offices or committees on the Hill, at least five ones, that are actually investigating the things he's doing. And so while he may not like the headlines and maybe he wants to blame journalists, the investigations are real. And, you know, there was one thing that as I was doing some research this week to prepare for his hearing yesterday, actually, it feels like forever ago. You know, the GAO has already said that the EPA probably broke a law by buying that soundproof booth that everyone thinks is a skiff and that isn't a skiff and cost $43,000 because they didn't tell Congress they were going to spend more than $5,000 on something. They've literally put in writing that they think this act, this anti-deficiency act, was broken. That's not the media saying that. That's them. And as long as all of these investigations are going on and there's more information going back and forth from Congress, we know Congress leaks when they get information, there will be more that comes out. And Scott Pruitt will continue to be embattled. However, Scott Pruitt is doing what the president promised he would do while he was on the campaign trail, which is roll back regulations that are that some would believe are stifling businesses in this country, especially oil and gas businesses, especially the coal business, which President Trump likes to tout as coming back to America. And Scott Pruitt has been championing that.
Right.
And in president's eyes, he's doing his job.
Mm. Well, let's get a call here. Kevin is calling from Monroe, North Carolina. You're on the air, Kevin.
Hi, Magnus. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is that I think Mr. Trump is the best thing that's has happened to this country as far as him being elected, because when all this corruption has been cleaned up, democracy for this country is going to be much stronger, and this country is going to be in a much better place. And also, it's going to set up for the Democrats to take over the political scene.
So Kevin, just to be clear here, when you say corruption, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about Mr. Trump and all the appointees, associates that he's tied up with, and they're so close to being tainted or being tied up in corruption.
I see. So in the cabinet level stuff we've been talking about. Kevin, thank you so much for your call. Michael Crowley, do you think Kevin's right to feel a sense of optimism?
I think from a Democratic perspective, the optimism is very high. I happened to talk to a pretty senior Democratic member of Congress last night, and I was struck by his kind of swagger in talking about the midterm elections. You know, I was sort of expecting him to lower expectations and say things are looking good, but you never know. And boy, he was kind of ready to go with a Democratic majority, at least in the House. I think Democrats are feeling very confident. I mean, an interesting question will be, however, as the midterm campaigns evolve, how much Democrats are campaigning on. You know, they have some interesting decisions to make about their message. Is this election about Donald Trump, corruption, the Russia scandal? Or, as this person was arguing to me, do Democrats have to really focus on those issues that may have been so fundamental to Trump's election, the economy, people feeling disenfranchised from Washington, parts of the country that are feeling left behind? And you know, those are two very different focuses. Obviously, different candidates in different places can have different messages. But I think that will be a fascinating question to watch, because I can tell you the media, it loves the sort of the storyline of, you know, are you going to impeach Trump? What kind of oversight hearings are we going to have? What kind of documents are you going to demand? And I think a lot of Democrats feel like they don't want to make that the heart of their campaign, that it's got to be about less glamorous things like job retraining.
Issues
right?
on the ground. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, we are talking about the week in the news. And you're hearing from Michael Crowley, National Senior Editor and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico, and from Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News, and from Jack Beattie, our own On Point News Analyst. After the break, we'll be talking about Bill Cosby's guilty verdict and gun control after the Waffle House shooting. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In other news this week, the suspected Golden State Killer was arrested this week on charges of raping and killing dozens of people in the 1970s and 80s. Bruce Harrington, brother of one of the murder victims, spoke Wednesday.
It is time for all victims to grieve and to take measure one last time to bring closure to the anguish that we've all suffered for the last 40 some odd years.
And in England, another royal baby, Prince William and Kate Middleton, welcomed their third child on Monday, Prince Louis Arthur Charles. Town crier Tony Appleton announced the birth.
Buckingham Palace, round me a note.
And Jenny Kavner became the first woman in over 20 years to call the televised play-by-play for a Major League Baseball team on Monday night.
And that ball is shot into left field. Fire up the fountains! She's gone!
I'm joined today by Michael Crowley. He's with Politico, Shauna Thomas with Vice News, and Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst as well. And before the break, Shauna and Jack, Michael had started talking, getting us down the road of talking about the midterm elections coming up in 2018. And once again, we sort of have a hint of how contested a lot of these races are going to be. For example, in Arizona, that even though the Democrats did close the gap there with their recent special election, Republican Debbie Lesko still wins anyway, Shauna.
Yes, she does. But I mean, that was a solidly red district that the last person who had it, Congressman Trump Franks, won hands down. The weird thing about that is because the Democrats sort of closed the margin, the gap a little bit, in some ways they're taking that as a win. They also forced the Republicans to spend more money in that special election than they probably should have had to spend in that special election. And that has been a pattern throughout all of these special elections that we've seen, that we've all been watching closely to see, you know, is there a Trump effect? Is something going to happen? Because it was a special election, so that means really only the most ardent of political watchers go and vote.
Right.
It was a solidly Republican district. She won, but if she only won by that little amount, Democrats are like, okay, what can we do in these districts that aren't like that?
Yeah.
And that gives them the swagger that Michael was talking about that, you know, a Democrat had last night when he was out.
Jack Beattie, what do you think?
Yes, I mean, that Arizona 8th district, according to one calculation, there are no less than 147 Republican held seats that are less friendly to the GOP than that one. That's scary for them. And yes, the disparity in spending. National Republican Committee, Congressional Committee spent $1 million. National Democratic Congressional Committee, zero. And there was a 16-point swing from what Trump's vote was just 2 years ago.
Mm. But Michael, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on the midterms, but since Jack did rightly bring up that there's been a lot of spending going on the other hand, the RNC as a whole, for example, has out-fundraised the Democrats by an enormous amount. So when we're talking about the 2018 midterms and races all over the country, I'm not sure if the Democrats are right to have so much swagger here because they're going to have to fight in every congressional district in the country.
Well, that's right. You know, the raw dynamics of, money and politics can overcome a lot of countervailing forces. I do think, however, and it's a little surprising because, you know, you would expect Democrats to be extremely energized at this moment in time and more so than Republicans, even though both sides are polarized. I still do think that all the evidence suggests a very, very big win for Democrats. You know, there are also some other recent data points. One that comes to mind in this conversation is the special election in rural Pennsylvania in mid-March, where Connor Lamb was elected a Democrat in a district that Trump had carried by 20 points in 2016. And keep in mind also, you know, I mentioned this question about what the focus of the campaign will be. Paul Manafort has two trials, one of which starts in July and one of which starts in September, at least as currently scheduled. That could change. Who knows whether Robert Mueller is going to there's some talk that he could release an interim report or at least provide it to Rod Rosenstein. It may not be released in public, but Mueller may have more indictments. He may have some kind of interim report he's working on. He may interview Trump. In other words, there are a lot of things happening with the Russia investigation that could blow up in the coming months and make it an even more toxic environment for Republicans.
I also think that in terms of the RNC's fundraising, you have to remember that that is connected to President Trump's fundraising in some respects when it comes to certain types of fundraisers. And the other thing you have to remember is President Trump has been running for re-election since the day after he took office. And so they have been fundraising. They have been fundraising on Facebook. They have been putting up online ads. They have been bringing in those dollars, and those dollars can be shared to a certain extent with the RNC. He has never stopped, and we have not seen that before. And that is something to, like, it may not affect 2018 as much, but it will affect 2020.
Yeah, we've never seen that before in a president,
but
in the House, for example, that's kind of the reality given
the constant
fundraising. Yeah. Well, let's switch gears here entirely because I do want to spend a couple of minutes talking about the fact that this week Bill Cosby was found guilty on three counts of aggravated indecent assault. And we have some tape here. This is Victoria Valentino. She traveled from California to attend the trial, and she said yesterday that she's grateful to the jury and to prosecutors who pursued this case. She accused Cosby of drugging and raping her in 1969.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. We are vindicated, we are validated, and we are now part of the tsunami of women's power and justice. We are not shutting up and we're not going away. Get over it.
Shauna, let me pick that up with you here because there's this great sense of relief, obviously, from Cosby's accusers. But it took years for them to get to this point, right? And the difference between this case and the last case, the last trial that Cosby faced, was that many more women were allowed to bring their stories, to the witness stand. So while I can understand that Victoria Valentino feels part of the tsunami, it was a tsunami that took decades to make.
That took decades. I mean, I am always reminded of NBC's Kate Snow's interview with about 50 of the Cosby accusers all telling their stories and nothing really happening around it. But also, I think the thing that has happened since the first case is the Me Too movement. So on top of the fact that you had these women who were allowed to bring their stories into the courtroom, even if they weren't able to have Cosby charged for anything, you also have women bringing their stories to, you know, the public courtroom, the newspapers, the television, speaking out about these things, making the language of speaking out about the people who attack you, the people who sexually assault you, the people who sexually harass you, a normal part of the conversation. And I think there is something to that affects a trial like this.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beattie, what do you think?
Yes, I subscribe to what Shauna said. I mean, the climate of opinion has just changed in the last year. The Cosby hung jury mistrial, that was just last June, and
right.
The jurors were all hung up about the definition of consent. Well, in the new climate of opinion, powerful men and their subordinates, people looking for help, for, you know, mentorship, whatever it might be, the question of consent is not an equal matter. It's not like, you know, we're just out on a date. No, no, no. There's power and wealth on one side and dependence on the other. And consent is the jurors just weren't bothered by all that. And you know, you have to wonder, not necessarily in a criminal case, because I don't know that there's anything criminal there. But Donald Trump, you know, was he going to have his day of reckoning in some public way? 20 women have accused him, credibly, I think, and their collective testimony buttresses the testimony of each one of them, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
Will that ever happen? Will the Me Too movement come to his door?
Let's take a call here. Emily is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Emily.
Hi, Magna. I just wanted to continue what Jack was talking about in terms of power and wealth and remind people that Bill Cosby had been on a speaking tour in 2004. So blaming African-Americans, blaming impoverished African-Americans for their own situations. And I just wanted to remind people of that and draw a parallel between the logic that says that, you know, impoverished people are there because they won't work hard and the logic that a woman who is raped when she's drugged is asking for it.
Ah, Emily, thank you so much for your call. Michael Crowley, what do you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, just stepping back, there's so much that's so horrible about the Cosby case. And one part of it is that Cosby was this avatar of, you know, wholesome values. And people did find that particular rhetoric, that more political rhetoric of his, to be moralistic and even offensive in some ways. But in general, you know, he was seen as a really wonderful guy trying to set a great example and make America a better place. And when you these revelations make you go back and think, who else did I grow up looking up to and laughing at and thinking was wonderful, who's actually a horrible person who either got away with it because, you know, the people haven't come forward or maybe passed away.
Yeah.
And there's something very rattling about that. It makes you kind of question your assumptions about the world and people in public life. But I think it's extremely healthy. We need to all just redouble our skepticism. And I don't know if I should say assume the worst about people, but and additionally, hope that this kind of behavior, at least in this category, is being stamped out as a result, so that we can have more faith in people in public life.
We've got just enough time here to talk about one more story for the week. And that is, Sean, I want to turn to you about this because it's about Gabby Giffords and gun control and sort of, you know, again, this conversation happening, of course, in the wake of the Waffle House shooting as well. So tell me about a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my team had spent some time with former Congresswoman Giffords when her and Mark Kelly were here for the March for Our Lives. But also we got to go back home to Arizona with her. And I think the interesting thing that we saw is that all of the work that goes into her trying to get better so many years since she was shot in the head in Arizona is really like some of the power of the work she does is because she wants to keep being able to use the voice that she has, which it is a limited voice. She will never be 100% again, but she wants to keep using it to continue the conversation about, you know, gun reform. She probably wouldn't use the term gun control, but she would say there are some reforms that need to be done. And I think the team that went down to Arizona was just struck by how much work it takes for her to be able to go to an event, for her to be able to leave the house, and that she keeps doing it. And so, I mean, I think it is a powerful reminder that gun violence affects people far away from the time that it actually happened to them, and that it always is a part of your life.
Yeah. Jack B., what do you think?
Well, she and her husband are inspiring. They're the, you know, there are no feeder clay there, as Michael was asking us to be skeptical. We can also be admiring of character when we see it. And we see it in both in both well, I don't know whether what name she takes, but Gabrielle Giffords and her husband, and they are putting their pain to the national good by crusading on this issue.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about the profundity or the heights that character can take. I think we should spend a minute or two talking about James Shaw Jr., who is the man who pried the rifle away from the gunman at the Waffle House in Tennessee, because not only did he do that, right, and help save lives, but he also helped raise $165,000 for victims of that shooting here. And, you know, in just in weeks that we had like this where there's so much negative news to focus on, my heart soars when I think of someone like James Shaw Jr. and all that he's done and continues to do. Michael Crowley, I mean, like, it's a high note for us to have to we should focus on as much as we focus on all the darker stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for saying that. You know, I'm trying to come up with something more to say than just, like, awesome. This guy is awesome, and you want everyone around you to be him. It's an incredibly inspiring story of, you know, both bravery in a terrifying moment, saving lives, and then clearly this sense of community and this this impulse to give and to help other people. He hasn't seemed to be trying to turn it into a kind of, you know, cheesy star tour, although he would be perfectly entitled to. So what more can you say? But may we all learn from him and try to emulate his character.
Shauna Thomas, I mean, what do you think?
I think that in some ways, one of the things that, to not to relate it back to something dark, but, you know, with Bill Cosby, we put a TV dad on some type of high mantle, and it was as someone to look up to. You know, there's real people in the real world and everybody's community that people can point their kids to look up to. And maybe, you know, maybe he is one of those people. And those people are all around you. And I think we got to teach everybody that.
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I don't want to bring too much cynicism to this as well. But one would hope that we as a country would recognize actions such as Shaw's even faster, you know, at the highest levels, right? Because over the course of the week, there was some concern that because James Shaw is African-American, maybe our nation's leaders didn't point to him as quickly as they should have and said, that is what a true hero does. Jack, I mean...
Yes. Well, one felt that. And his comment to me is the barrel was so hot when he grabbed the barrel of the gun. I mean, what a sort of emblem of his bravery. And, you know, these things happen. Clint Eastwood made a movie about those young American men on that train to go into Paris. People step forward, and that keeps the sort of the light of possibility lit.
And let that light shine as brightly as possible for as long as possible. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much for joining us, as always, Jack.
Thank you, Magna.
And Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Really great to speak with you, Shauna. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael Crowley, National Security Editor and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Great to talk with you, Michael. Thank you.
So great to be here. Thank you.
And folks, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.